underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Joyce Carol Oates is considered one of America's most prolific storytellers. She's written more than 50 novels, and the total number of books published comes in at around 160. Some have won the highest honors in American fiction, ranging from the National Book Award to being awarded the National Humanities Medal from President Obama in 2010. She's also a five-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. She's written about everything, from Marilyn Monroe to boxing, often probing the dark side of human nature. She currently has a pair of books out, The Lost Landscape, a memoir, and Soul at the White Heat, Inspiration, Obsession, and the Writing Life. For this week's book show, we spoke to Joyce Carol Oates as part of The Creative Life, a conversation series at the University at Albany. Our conversation was taped in September before a live audience in the university's Performing Arts Center.
We're talking tonight, we have an entire series about the creative life. And I'm curious, maybe just to start, is for you, when you are creating, when you are writing, are there ingredients that need to be in place? Are there things that you have to be able to create? I remember Maya Angelou saying to me one time when she was writing a poem, she would check into a hotel and she had a Bible, a dictionary, and a bottle of Chivas. Are there ingredients for you?
Well, I need a minimum of one cat. So I actually have two cats, and one is in reserve in case something happens.
Just the backup.
I kind of walk across the laptop and interesting stylistic things. Sort of people think I'm an experimental writer, but it was just that the cat walked in a certain way. No, I need that. I think it's kind of solace in sitting in a familiar place, looking out a window. I have a garden, and not an ambitious garden. It's just a garden that I put in with black-eyed Susans and coneflowers and butterfly bush and waiting for monarchs to come, and almost none came this summer. And so that gives me a sense of comfort. I'm on a second floor, and I'm looking down, and I have these two cats, and I have photographs of beloved family members, many of them not alive any longer, and they're sort of on the windowsill. So I think all of that gives a kind of talismanic sense of comfort. I could write somewhere else, but this is just sort of a comfortable zone.
You talk about solace, and in the book, The Lost Landscape, A Writer's Coming of Age, which is just out in paperback, you write that I must have been a lonely child. I know that I was a secretive child, yet I must have loved my aloneness. Until the age of 12 or 13, my most intense, happiest hours were spent trampling desolate fields, woods, creek banks near my family's farmhouse in Millersport, New York. No one knew where I went. I was an articulate verbal child for whom language was both a means of communication and a scrim behind which I might hide unseen. Do you still use that scrim?
Well, I think most writers do. Writers and poets create a kind of secondary personality with language, and there's a real person behind it somewhere, who knows where. But I had to smile when you were reading that, because I actually still feel that way. And I said, till the age of 12 or 13, but really it went beyond that. This feeling that wandering around alone and looking at things. I spent a lot of time walking along a creek bank and going into places where I wasn't supposed to be. And there's a section in the book where I talk about the no trespassing signs and how alluring they are.
Yes.
And I've heard other people say that too, that you never would have thought of trespassing except the sign says no trespassing. You think, well, that's sort of inviting. So out in the country, there are a lot of posted signs and no trespassing signs, you know, and woods and fence posts and so forth. And when I was growing up, there were a lot of abandoned houses. This is the aftermath of the Depression. So there might be a completely abandoned farm, and you could go just wander around there and see an old barn that had been left to sort of decay. So the smells of an old barn, the hay and sunshine, the smell of lilac, all these smells are very, very pungent in my memory.
You talk about, even in the book, of even though there is this place and after the Depression, but of a secrecy of the place and even a violent tendency to the place.
Yes, if you look into it. I think as a child I was growing up and somewhat protected by my parents, and yet there were glimmers of things that had happened in the neighborhood, and children who had been mistreated and women who had been badly treated by men. And these things were not talked about openly, but one could sort of gather what was going on. As I got older, I think I really was kind of fascinated by these mysteries.
When you think of those mysteries, were those things that you were ultimately trying to explore even early on in your writing? We think of you as someone who can so beautifully probe the dark side of our human nature. Is it that uneasiness that allowed that very early?
Well, it's hard to answer. I think children begin with a kind of wonderment and infinite curiosity about adults. You have to imagine that we're lying in a crib, you know, and you're looking up and you see these faces, and they may be the faces of your young parents and grandparents and other adults are sort of looking at you. So our earliest visual memories would be of these strange faces. And babies immediately at birth, babies can recognize faces. I don't mean they know who the people are, but they know a face. It's true for, I think, all mammals. A little baby chimpanzee can recognize a face if you show like a drawing of a face. The baby will recognize that that's a face. I find that very interesting. And my new novel has a lot of neuroscience in it, and my husband's a neuroscientist. And so it all kind of comes together. That immediate recognition of faces, the baby has to recognize the face of the parents. It's very important that we have facial identification for our survival. So I would imagine you're lying in your crib and you're looking out at these faces, and then later on you get a little older and now you're short and these tall people are around you. It's natural to be very, very curious about them. You know, and our parents are mysterious to us when we're really little. Sometimes as we grow up, they're still somewhat elliptical and ambiguous.
Did you write many of the pieces in this book to explore that, to try to solve some of those mysteries?
Well, the book was written over a period of maybe 10, 12, or even 15 years. It was written over a period of time. So each chapter is a standalone, and then when I revised the chapters to make a book, I made them more unified. But it was a book I would not have written except in that way. I mean, I would never have sat down and wrote a book called The Lost Landscape. I don't think I would have had the emotional energy to do that. But what happens if you're a writer is that editors invite you to participate, let's say, in a symposium. And the subject might be your earliest memory. Or the subject might be write about a favorite snapshot from your childhood. Or the subject might be write about your mother. That was Oprah's magazine had a special feature, interview your own mother. Well, that's something I would never, ever have thought of doing. Then the New York Times Magazine editor asked me to write about my father and so forth. So each one of these was called forth by some other person. In fact, one of them was relatively recently, an airline magazine asked me to write about my first airplane flight. And I wouldn't have written about that, but my father flew small airplanes as a hobby. So the first plane that I was in was my father's airplane that he had rented. So I have like, you know, 3 pages on that. So all these things just added up, and I would have this little manuscript and go in one of my rooms where it would be getting kind of bigger and bigger, and finally it became a book.
For this week's book show, we spoke to Joyce Carol Oates as part of The Creative Life, a conversation series at the University at Albany. Our conversation was taped in September before a live audience in the university's Performing Arts Center.
You can look at it as really the second memoir that you have written.
Yes. Very different from the first one. Well, this memoir is all in the past. Every sentence is past tense, because I'm looking back over many, many years, even decades, I'm looking back. One little chapter is about the first person I knew, my own age, who died. And she actually had committed suicide. But nobody would talk about it. It was completely taboo and completely secret. So at the time it happened, we didn't really talk about it. So when I wrote about it, now, decades later, I was able to talk about it, and even to write down how she died, which I had never done before. So all that is past tense, but my first memoir is called A Widow's Story, and that's all present tense. That's a journal. So my husband was hospitalized with pneumonia, and I just started writing. I was at the hospital all the time, and I couldn't do my regular writing, so I was writing like in a journal. But everything was present tense. Like, I didn't really know what would happen tomorrow. You know, like day one, day two, day three. And then he was coming home next Tuesday. But on this, about midnight, one of these nights, I got a telephone call, and he was actually dying. And I was totally stunned. And in a way, I guess I've never gotten over that telephone call, because I can't answer the phone now, and I don't really want to hear a phone ringing. Something goes through you forever when something like that happens. But anyway, after my husband died, I just continued with this journal, and each day I would write, usually at night when I couldn't sleep. But I never really knew what the next day would be, or the next day, and I did that for about 3 months. The memoir takes place over 6 months, but it was 3 months that was really intense. So the two memoirs are completely different. One is a journal of things that are happening, and the writer doesn't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And the other is a writer. The writer knows everything that happened, because some of it was like, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. I thought it was an interesting experience to write these two different journals.
You spoke of this book, The Lost Landscape, of doing it in sections and individual pieces over 10 years, and saying you're not sure if emotionally you would want to go and for start to finish and write a memoir of your childhood.
I don't think I could have done that, no.
Is that because of memory and what memory of how it affects us, or the exploring? Because certainly in this, in talking about the death of your husband, I mean, that also is a very emotional, raw thing.
Well, the death of the husband was so shocking in every way that I was just sort of stunned. And each day seemed to be filled with all kinds of surprises and absurdities. And I was just really felt overwhelmed, and I wasn't writing fiction. I was writing the way I felt. But then I had interrelations with people, and I think one of the morals of my memoir is that it's people who help you, that your friends, or maybe someone in your family. I didn't have any family, so it was about 3 friends and maybe 3 or 4 people. And they were mostly women. And they just sort of came forward, and they kind of took care of me. Now, I'm not saying I could never have predicted how weak I would be when we have ideas about ourselves that are not based on anything much. But I think it's like you have a profound physical malaise, like you have a virulent fever and you can barely get out of bed, and you think, what's happened to me? I mean, this, you know, it was very, very strange. Whereas with the other memoir, I was completely in control. It was more or less my decision. An editor would ask me to write about a certain subject, and so I would clear time on my desk, you know, and I would take up that subject, looking at old photographs. One of the subjects was to write for the New Yorker about my first job and other jobs when I was young, like a teenager. Now, I would never have thought of writing about that, but that really took me back to these crazy jobs and these things I was trying to do when I was a teenager, some of them really funny and pathetic, and then when I was in college. So it's sort of reminiscing, but I wouldn't have thought that it was that important to write about myself. And then another subject was also the New Yorker, when Tina Brown was editor, to write about some experience of being a woman or a girl, like a female experience when you were quite young that you found surprising and unexpected. So I wrote about the girl next door who basically was being abused by her own father, but at the time nobody said that. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know anything. I was like, you know, I was quite young. And so all these subjects were sort of put to me. When I teach writing at Princeton, I have undergraduates, and the course consists of my giving students assignments. They often say, well, I can't do that. But I said, well, you have to do it, so you have no choice. So one of them is like a dramatic monologue in a voice different from your own. So a young man has to write a dramatic monologue, maybe of an older person or maybe of a young woman or a woman, you know. And so you find yourself doing things you wouldn't have thought of. So I was grateful to these editors for suggesting these subjects to me. I wouldn't have thought of it myself. Whereas the widow's story was completely my own experience, and nobody told me to write that. It was a way of trying to comprehend what was going on.
It is so difficult to, and I know we've talked about this in past conversations, in talking to you without mentioning the fact of how prolific you are. And I know, as we've said before, that for you, it doesn't seem like it's coming quick, right? You don't consider yourself a fast writer necessarily.
No, I'm actually not. It's very slow. Incredibly slow. Like, I can't believe it. You know.
So next week, your third book this year will come out.
Well, actually, if anybody could see me working and you kind of, you know, look over my shoulder or like my kitty is like asleep beside the laptop, you'd see I spend so much time revising. And then I some inch forward, and I don't understand how I finish anything. And like I usually come in the morning fairly early to my desk, and I revise what I did the day before. I usually write it over because somehow I think I can make it better, and then I get a little momentum, so I start writing into the next scene. I do a lot of writing in my hand, and it's actually quite slow. But I have a theory that we can't write any faster than we do. Like if James Joyce said it took 7 years to write Ulysses, if he'd had a word processor, he could not have written it in 1 year or 7 months. I think because there's something about living through that period of time. So I've been working on a novel now for some months, and it seems to go so slowly, but I'm almost wondering whether it can't go any faster for some psychological reason. And I find that kind of an interesting idea, that because I have not been able to finish this chapter, the next day I had a better idea for something to put in it. Whereas if I'd written it yesterday, it wouldn't have been that good. So that's happened several times. So it's like I'm moving a little more slowly than I think I should because I haven't quite worked out the best way of doing it.
And you are also able to work on multiple projects.
No, I usually just do one. And I might stop between chapters and write a book review or a short story. But usually, like, one novel is very engrossing, so you sort of stay with the novel.
Do you set a time frame for yourself, or is that dangerous?
You mean to finish a novel?
Yes.
No. I don't think that one could do that reasonably. There's no deadline. There's no deadline.
And obviously your publishers don't worry because they know you'll come through.
I don't think. I think it's for the opposite. They're worried what's coming. They say, what? Another long novel, Joyce?
For this week's book show, we spoke to Joyce Carol Oates as part of The Creative Life, a conversation series at the University at Albany. Our conversation was taped in September before a live audience in the university's Performing Arts Center.
Do you have a sense of, in your mind, of what is next? You're working on this novel now. You've been working on it for several months. So are you thinking ahead? Do you know, oh, I could do this, I could do that?
Oh, I always have the ending of a novel. I know where it's going, and I have the main chapters. It's just a matter of getting to it, a matter of realizing the scenes. And I've come to like my characters so much, and I think our lives are basically these wonderful stories that are sort of interlocked. You know, you meet somebody, and out of your meeting with this person is generated some sort of history or narrative, and that's like a story. And you don't have to meet very many people in a life to have a profound set of stories. I'm speaking of a memorable meeting. So we all remember when we met a memorable person. But if you had not met that person, then that story wouldn't exist. So we see how our lives in real time mimic short stories. It's in short stories, people come together and they have interrelations. In novels, people are meeting and it generates these plots. So my characters are basically, it's a mimesis of life. They're imitating the rhythms of life.
Do you look at your body of work and examine it at times just to catalog, to understand where you have or how you have evolved as a writer?
No, I don't think so. Most of us are not eager to look at our bodies. We kind of look the other way, you know. Body of work. No, it would take too long. I'd be rereading my own work on my deathbed. I'll say, wait, I'm only on page 90. I have several books to go. I have 16 books, and I'm on my deathbed. William Butler Yeats was actually revising on his deathbed.
My question also about that idea of you, as you were first describing that, you seem as, and maybe I misread it, but it seemed like that's something you enjoy.
I love the revise.
Yeah.
Yes, when I'm all done with a novel, I feel such a yearning and such a loss, a little melancholy. I felt I could walk out on the street and say, who's got a novel for me to revise? Manuscript. There's something about having the manuscript there or a page or a chapter and revising it. It's just such a pleasure. But writing the first draft is more, you feel sort of dangerous. Like it's like going across a tightrope without a net. Once you have the draft, then you have sort of a net there. So I'm just thrilled to rewrite. I find that really exciting. And I teach my students how to really like to rewrite. What a thrill it is to have a good story and to know it's good, but then to know it can be better. So the next time you write it, it gets better. That's really a nice feeling.
Joyce Carol Oates is our guest. The new book in the paperback is The Lost Landscape, A Writer's Coming of Age. The new hardcover, Soul at the White Heat, Inspiration, Obsession, and the Writing Life. I hope you'll join me in thanking Joyce Carol Oates.
Joyce Carol Oates has a pair of new books out, The Lost Landscape, a memoir, and Soul at the White Heat, Inspiration, Obsession, and the Writing Life. We spoke to Joyce Carol Oates as part of The Creative Life, a conversation series at the University at Albany. Our conversation was taped in September before a live audience and the university's Performing Arts Center. Support for the series comes from the University at Albany Foundation. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.